Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host, Matt Watson. Excited to be joined today by Adam Juddelson, who's the founder and CEO of First Principles. His company is, well, we're going to call it a product agency. They provide services and talent to help you figure out product problems. So today we're going to talk all about product problems. And, you know, I come from more of the engineering side and have always overseen the product and engineering side. But I think in a lot of companies, a lot of the problems are actually on the product side. They don't get the right requirements. Developers don't know what to do. Everybody's frustrated. So we're going to talk about that and much more today with Adam. I'm sure he's going to give us lots of good lessons about what a product team is and how a product team is really critical to the success of tech companies. Before we get started, I do want to remind you that today's episode is brought to you by Fullscale. Adam has a product agency. I have a dev agency. So if you need help growing your software development team, Fullscale can help. Front end, back end, mobile, QA, all the different things. You can check us out at fullscale.io. Adam, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you so much for having me here. Excited to be on.
Yeah. So what the hell is a product team? I think that's a good place to start because I think most tech people are like, I need a developer. I need a CTO. I don't know what to tell them to do. So what is product?
Yeah, I think this is a great question and a fantastic place to start because ultimately it's one of those things that you can get access to almost every other part of the problem. Like you said, from an agency just like yours, you can hire QA, you can hire devs, you can hire all these different people. But the pattern that I see over and over again in startups is that people have a lot of really good ideas. They come up with those ideas, they assemble a team to build against those ideas, they build those ideas, and then they ship them into the market. And then what happens?
Wait a second. No, wait a second. They change ideas after 1 week.
Change ideas violently, re-architect, decide that the real problem is, you know, some arbitrary button color or something like that. And then they ship the product to the market. And then what happens is literally nobody notices. And if you haven't gone through this harrowing experience yourself, it's nearly impossible to believe that it is, in fact, the most likely outcome for just about any product company that has ever been founded. And so, you know, it's easy to just look at the stories on the internet and see about all the successful ones. And so the way I like to think about it is, you know, what is the actual probability that the thing that you release into the market is actually adopted and used in the market? And I always like to tell product teams and CPOs and CEOs that at the end of the day, there's only two metrics that matter. And we'll talk about like what a product person really does to achieve these in a second. But there's only two things that really matter for product people. Are they growing the revenue of the business? And are they growing the traction or the impact of that business? And I like to think of those as separate because they're not always the same thing. You know, sometimes you can double your user count, but not increase your revenue. And sometimes you can double your revenue and not really impact users in any way. So I think it's important to keep both of those goals in mind. And product people are right at the center of it. And, you know, the irony of the product job is you directly do almost none of the things. You're not sales. You don't close the deals. You're not engineering. You don't actually build the thing. You're not design. So you don't actually design the thing. But it is, in fact, your job to make sure that all of those parts come together to make sure that you are producing value for the market. YC likes to describe it as build things that people want. I think that's a good start. They have to be things that people want. They also have to be things that people pay for. And YC is actually very good at calling that out as well.
But the challenge is at most early stage companies, the person who's charging of product is one of the founders. Yep. And they don't actually know how to do any of this. But all of a sudden, yep, they are in charge of product.
Yes, yes. And this is, I would argue, the opportunity and the challenge. The opportunity is that founders are in this position and they don't know how to do it. And, you know, they have the best of intentions and they've read a lot and they've absorbed a lot, but almost every single principle of product management is counterintuitive, right? So for example, if you go back 10 or 15 years, most founders just kind of did what they wanted and that resulted in utter failure. 10 years later, most founders are like, oh, I know that I need to spend some time talking to users. So they go talk to users, except they don't actually internalize that the goal in talking to users is not to go figure out exactly how you should build the product. You know, famous quote that you've probably heard Henry Ford saying, if I had asked everybody what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse, not a car, right? And so almost all of the intuition around how you should build something great is opposite to what you would conclude in the first stage of learning in your journey. And learning how to parse those things is really where the expertise comes in. And so ultimately, product people, and I think Marty Kagan sets a nice description of this. He ultimately says product people are responsible for, at a minimum, two things: proving the value of the thing that you're building. Are people actually going to want to use it? Will they actually buy it? And proving the internal viability of the thing. Now, the internal viability usually comes up a little bit more often in bigger companies than it does in the small ones, because it really talks to, you know, is this going to be legal? Is it going to be ethical? Will your sales team be able to sell it? Are the internal costs of producing it serious? I'll give an example. I wrote a blog post a few weeks ago about, you know, what is the minimum cost that your product has to be in the market in order to use ChatGPT very heavily under the hood? That's a viability question. By the way, spoiler alert, the answer is about $113 a month or more. Otherwise, you're basically going to get eat up on costs. And so those are the other category of problems. But I also personally think, and this is where I diverge with some of the other thinkers, that product people, like the management part of product management, needs to also include the usability, the technical feasibility, and I like to think of the craftsmanship as its own entire category as well that tends to blend in with usability. But there's also a lot of other decisions in craftsmanship, like which data sources should be available, what options should be in this menu or not in this menu. Those thousands of tiny decisions add up at the end of the day to make something that people either absolutely love or absolutely hate. Well, so at the end of the day, it's those five.
Well, and that's the challenge with product is product in a very early stage company is the basics of the features, the roadmap, like really fundamental things, right? Then you can do a really large company, like let's say you work at Spotify in the product team. You have somebody there where their whole goal is to figure out, okay, how do we get more people to listen to podcasts? Or something like that, right? And or you're in a large company and it's almost like product marketing, right? Or documentation or like different kinds of functions that kind of revolve around a product team. And it's very different from one company to another. So the first question I have for you though is most startups cannot afford a product team. They also cannot afford not to have a product team because they're going to fail in so many different ways, unless they have a founder that maybe has done this before and has a good grasp on how to build a product and how to build a tech product, right? So what advice do you have for like early stage startups that don't have a lot of funding, they can't afford a product team, they can't necessarily afford to do these things the right way? How should they be thinking about product? Like what are their priorities?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of different layers to that question. I'll try to answer them in sequence a little bit. The first thing is, you know, for a company like mine, we want to be friendly to that situation. So we have scaled pricing. If you're a Fortune 500 company, you pay a different amount than a seed stage company that's only raised a few bucks. That's the first thing. The second thing is, in terms of practically, how do you deal with this? I think that one of the first things that founders have to realize, and this is why, by the way, I will flat out say, half of all founders will never have a conversation with me, and that's okay with me, because they don't have the internal ability to accept that they might not be right. And as a result of that, it will ultimately plague their entire startup unless they get their first bet out of the gate exactly correct. And unfortunately for the world, a few people do actually get the bet perfectly correct if you think about how many startups are started each year. So some people come to the mistaken conclusion that like that is exactly how this works. You just kind of like birth a perfect idea. The idea immediately gains traction and you run and go. But what I like to draw people's attention to is if you think about, I even have a calculator on my website where you put in the number of engineers you have on your team and it tells you what your approximate burn is and the approximate percentage increase in value if you just sharpened your strategy by 20%, 30%, 40%. And the reality is, even for a small company, we're talking about a couple $100,000 a month, maybe $500,000 per month. And so you have to ask yourself, like, is your engineering team producing that amount of value every single month? And if they're not, there's a pretty darn good chance that you have a product problem. Or if you're deploying your product and nobody's using it, there's a pretty good chance that you have a product problem. And so what I like to tell people is, you know, you're basically thinking about this backwards. The way to think about it is first have something of value and then build the thing. I'll give an example from my past, which I think is an interesting one. So I spent about 2 years at Deloitte helping them to build one of their first product startups inside of the worldwide consultancy. And that was a very difficult bureaucratic challenge. But one of the things that I noticed is if you define product as a technical solution to a problem that someone has, which is not how I define product, by the way, then a company like Deloitte has literally tens of thousands of products that are being deployed. The difference is I like to define it as a thing that solves N people's problems with the same exact code, right? And so when you look at a company like that, you have to ask yourself, well, how does a company that's that big and is not a product company have all of these technical solutions that they sell in the market? And the answer is companies like that, they don't build a single thing until they've sold it. And I think that's one of the few lessons that product companies and product founders can actually learn from consulting, because frankly, most of the principles are opposite in those two domains. But that's one that I think is really interesting. And so one of the things I talk to a lot of, especially emerging tech founders about, is they say, well, you know, I'm building this new satellite system and it's going to do something that no one's ever done before. And it's going to take 2 years before the satellite even exists and before it even has its first test flight. So how could we possibly prove out the value of the thing that we're building? And I like to give them the very simple answer of put it in a PowerPoint deck and go try to sell it. See what happens. Put all the features, put all the value propositions, imagine that it already exists perfectly and go see what happens when you try to sell it. And in a way, I even have a blog post on this where basically my argument is that in a really early stage emerging tech company, your PowerPoint deck is your product, especially if you have the types of assumptions that can't be easily tested. Now, for most other companies that aren't building super complicated hardware, there are thousands of ways of building much, much smaller pieces of the product and testing those directly in the market. You don't have to just use a PowerPoint deck, for example. So there's a lot of tricks of the trade to actually buy down that risk so that when you deploy it, you can be pretty sure that people are going to actually buy it.
Well, I think you touched on something earlier that is, it's both a strength and a weakness of founders where they don't necessarily want to hear the truth. Or they're willing to do whatever it takes to make an idea work, even if it's kind of a terrible idea. And part of the challenge is people won't tell them the truth, or they're like, oh yeah, sounds like a great idea. Keep going. You know, so there's a lot of people that are like, I refer to as kind of being Midwestern nice around here. Like people won't tell them the hard truth of like, oh, this is a stupid idea. Right. But then a lot of founders won't accept that either. Like they won't accept the defeat. Kind of like you said, it's like they will keep going anyways. And I think we've all been there because I think it's I don't know, is it the sunken cost fallacy? I don't know what the name of it is, but it's like they've already put so much effort into it, they're just going to keep going anyways. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's a strength and a weakness because a certain percentage of them end up being successful because of that.
The nuance is what's critical here, right? So the founder needs to be unstoppable in the face of solving new problems that arise. But the founder must also be 100% intellectually honest with themselves and ideally with their executive team or their founding team about which of those things are and aren't working so that collective energy of the executive team, the accounting team, can actually focus on solving those super duper hard problems. And where it falls over is, like you said, and by the way, I've been in these shoes, like I get it. The incentives are insane. The incentives are so strong, especially if you've already raised a couple million dollars right out of the gate, to effectively hide the lack of traction instead of owning the lack of traction, not want to tell anybody about that, not want to admit that there's ugly skeletons.
Yeah.
And the reality is, like, there are very, very few startups that do not exit the womb in some sort of struggle state, right? And it's really only the very intellectually honest and, you know, sort of very, you have to have a certain personality toughness, even in the face of your naysayers. Because if you think about it, for a founder, and you know this at full scale, it doesn't matter if it's a product company or an agency, at some level, the success of your company, and I think this is a bad thing, but this is how society views it, or at least how founders view it. We think the success of the company is a direct reflection on our success as an individual. And so it's really difficult to have these honest conversations, which is one of the reasons why, like, I don't name too many of my clients, right? Sometimes I do, you know, if I get permission from them, but frequently they don't necessarily want to admit that they're working with somebody on these topics. Whereas I think of it as like, hey, you should totally admit it, because you should think about it as we're actually maximizing the upside opportunity of your business, not necessarily fixing a problem per se. But we see both scenarios.
Well, I actually posted on LinkedIn about this today, about after being, you know, in product development for the last 20 years, like, I consider myself kind of an expert at building software. But now that I'm a CEO of a company, I realize there's so many things I'm not an expert at, be it sales, marketing, operations, legal, raising capital, name the thing. There's a lot of them. And I've also come to really appreciate having other people's expertise. Right? Like, and I think as a founder, though, some of us have to be able to swallow, like, okay, I'm not an expert at that thing, and I'm willing to hire somebody that is the expert. And a lot of startup founders are probably a little more ego-driven, a little more narcissist. It's a little more in the DNA, and some struggle with that, right? But I think it's really important to know when to call in those experts and have them come in and help. I put in there, it's like, I want Patrick Mahomes. Bring in Patrick Mahomes and let's win this thing, right? Like, I'm tired of, like, screwing around, trying to figure it out myself. And, you know, recently I've hired a couple people that were, like, huge, phenomenal hires that really pushed us forward by bringing in those experts. But is that something, from your experience, that a lot of founders struggle with?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And the main reason, though, I find it's not an obstacle to getting help for the 50% who are open to getting help. It's an obstacle in knowing whose help to trust. The
right.
Founders that I work with are super intelligent, super thoughtful. They've read all the stuff. They've watched all the videos. They know that they're supposed to be getting help. They know that they're not supposed to try to solve every single job themselves.
Yeah.
But for example, I think your firm is a great example of this, because I get asked this question all the time. They're like, how do I know which dev shop I can trust?
100%.
Right? And they have the same question about me. How do I know, you know, there aren't many product agencies, but, you know, of my product agency, how do they know that they can trust me?
Yeah.
How do they know that this is actually going to work for them? And part of what I say is you've got to do trials. You know, and I'm doing these trials all the time, even inside my own business. For example, I don't do any TikTok marketing, not at all right now. And I don't have any clients that are currently doing any TikTok marketing. I don't know how to pick a TikTok marketing agency. I have more background than most of the CEOs that I work with, because I have run digital ads for multiple companies before, and I have been involved in that process, even though I wouldn't consider it to be a primary product discipline. It's more of a marketing discipline than a product one. But I've been around long enough that I've been around these things, and I could make a decent list of how to select such an agency. But the best thing that I could possibly do, if that's the path that I wanted to go down, I would eke out a budget and I would go try like 5 different agencies. And I would also pulse my network on, like, you know, which ones are good, right? That's going to save a lot of time too. But once you get them into the driver's seat, you're going to figure out how it works. And even in the negotiations, you're going to figure out how serious they are. I actually talked to one the other day and I couldn't believe this. Their ad was basically like, you don't pay us anything until, you know, we find you fantastic qualified leads. And I was like, sounds too good to be true, but I'll take the phone call. And I took the phone call, and, you know, it turns out the contract is, well, you know, we don't take a percentage of your revenue until we've gotten you new leads, but we do actually charge you this massive upfront fee to do work. And I was like, so let me get this straight. Your ad says that you believe
in it. Don't trust you anymore.
Don't actually believe in it. Right. And I think the point is, like, a lot of CEOs, they don't even have that call. But now that I've had that call, if I did have the second call, I'd be a more informed buyer, right? And so, you know, even when you have a bad agency or a bad coach or someone who's bad at helping you, the best way, in my view, to see that is to actually have tried multiple in that regard and just set a budget so that, you know, you're not destroying the company over outside fees.
Well, and you're 100% right. And, you know, after running Full Scale for several years, we know that sales is 100% based off trust. People don't respond to cold email or cold phone call or whatever. And so if you need a dev agency you can trust, you can check us out at fullscale.io. We have over 300 employees. We have worked for over 100 different companies. So back to the product side of this for a minute. I'm curious, you know, back to early stage companies, what is the big difference? Actually, let me ask you this. So at what point in time do you think a early stage company should hire like a full-time product person, be that a product owner, a product manager, VP, product, chief product officer, you pick the title. When do you think they should make that hire?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. It depends a little on the context, and I'll get into the specifics in a moment, but it is a funny question because every one of my successful fractional engagements ends the same way, which is they hire somebody full-time to do the role, right? And so I think a lot about this, like what are the actual conditions that lead to a thoughtful transition? Like when should this actually happen? And the first thing that I would say is it has a ton to do with who is on your founding team. So if your founding team is like a born salesperson and a born engineer, and neither of them have ever dabbled in product, depending on how quickly they can sell the product, they might want to hire a product person very early on, or at least get fractional support in product very early on. But if you've got a CTO who leans a little bit into the actual building aspect and has some, you know, instincts around not everybody's going to love everything we build, and they have that initial understanding, or the CEO at some point was a product person, then I think you can actually wait quite a long time before you actually bring on a full-time product hire. And generally, what I would say in those cases where the discipline of product can be done by other people in little pieces, you know, the CEO does this piece of it, the CTO does that piece of it, and no one describes it this way in real time, but in essence, those roles are being done. If they're being done by the founding team or by other people on that team, then I generally recommend waiting until you actually have pretty clear signs of product market fit. And by clear signs of product market fit, I mean people are starting to buy the product in increasing numbers, and you're no longer able to satisfy the demand of all the new engagements that are beginning to support that product. So I would wait a long time. In short, I wait a long time if you think you have those skills inside your founding team and you just need to kind of pull them out and coach them up on those things. And if you don't have them at all, then I would recommend that you find someone you can really trust. But the thing I wouldn't do early on, if you're going to hire a product person very early on, I would not make that person chief product officer. And the reason for that is because it immediately introduces tension between the founders and the CEO, because anyone with the job title of VP of product or chief product officer, they're going to expect that they get to own the strategy and a significant portion of the vision for the product. And if you're not in total lockstep on that, it's just not going to happen. Whereas a line product manager who's very talented, who loves working in early phase companies, who's happy to receive the vision from the founding team, is going to be able to produce far more spectacular outcomes without any of that drama. And by the way, I say this as a former CPO and former VP of product and as a former line product manager. I've been through all of those phases, and I know what people are expecting in their careers at those phases. So you just have to be smart about what your business is capable of without those people and what your business is capable with them.
Well, that makes total sense. As an early stage company, the last thing I'd want to do as a founder is sort of think I'm going to outsource my product vision to this person I just randomly hired, right? Like now I can see late in a later stage company or they're helping eventually take that over or what have you and continue like, you know, the direction of where it's already going. So from your experience, when do companies hire a chief product officer though? Is that like once they're doing millions of dollars in revenue, and I mean, a chief product officer can be a very expensive hire. When do companies usually hire a CPO?
So I find, and I don't know if this is intentional or not, I'm not an HR person by background, but I find that they tend to hire a VP of product before they hire a chief product officer. And it's a weird distinction because honestly, there's virtually no difference between those jobs other than what the people who are surrounding those jobs believe in their head is supposed to be true. So for example, on some teams, the CPO will participate in board meetings, but the VP of engineering or VP of product will not. But to me, that's a completely arbitrary distinction. But to answer your question more directly, yeah, it's generally speaking, millions of dollars, tens of thousands of users if you're on the consumer side. If you're on the B2B SaaS side, depending on your price point, maybe it's only a few thousand, maybe it's only a thousand. I've got some companies that I work with, though, that are building deep enterprise tech where after three or four big clients, they're ready to go and have somebody to take that over. And the thing that I like to emphasize is, you know, a lot of people get really confused between the terms mission, vision, and strategy. It's entirely okay for the founders to say, I've defined the vision, which is to say the state that I want to be true for my customers in the future. And I now want to hire somebody to go figure out what that should actually look like. Like, how do we manifest the vision? So to give a concrete example, everyone knows, you know, Elon Musk builds rockets, he builds reusable rockets. You know, his mission is to make us an interplanetary species, but that doesn't tell you anything about what they're going to build. But the vision early on at SpaceX was to build a reusable rocket. But just because he set the vision doesn't mean that it was clear to everybody how we should build a reusable rocket. So that's where you bring somebody in who has experience in product and you say, okay, we want to build a reusable rocket. How the heck do we go do that? Yeah. And then figuring out those next thousand moves, that's the job of a fantastic CPO or VP of product.
Well, to your point, it's dramatically different from one industry or product type from another, right? Where most startups are building like a simple web application or something like that is totally different than like, we're going to send humans to Mars, you know, like whole different world. But, you know, we talk about hiring like a CPO or VP of product, but a lot of companies probably do like need a product owner or project manager or somebody that's a little more low level in the weeds, right? So what is your take on when they need that kind of person?
Yeah, I think the key there is they need that person as soon as the chaos exceeds the value, if that makes sense, right? So once engineers are confused about what they're supposed to be working on, or there's too many tickets flying around, or there's nobody to set up the user interviews, then I think it makes sense to start having somebody who is actually in that job of managing the project itself, not the product. Yeah. And I think where this gets unfortunately really messy is that though there were some really fantastic founding principles for Agile, the industry itself spawned a series of Scrum coaches that basically overemphasized this role of product owner and made people think, oh, if I have a product owner, if I have this person speaking on behalf of the customer, magically everything will happen. But like we talked about in the very beginning, these product owners, they're not business experts. They're not experts on how the technology is evolving. They're not actually experts on the customer. They tend to be like expert on just their personal use case. They have no knowledge of how to interview users. They have no knowledge of how to run experiments. And so it leads to this like just utter collapse. So what I would recommend is, and the term that's become more and more popular in the industry these days is product ops or product operations. I think that's a great name for it. And I had the luxury of building a couple of products that way in my early Palantir days, where I got to pair with someone who's just amazingly great at the execution, made sure that whatever we dreamed up, whatever we validated, whatever we knew was going to actually work and test in the market, that actually got done. But where I think you run into trouble is if you hire somebody who really wants to be a product manager, and then you put them in that role, but they don't have the coaching and the skill to become a fantastic product manager, then they will always be disappointed that they're like sort of only doing the execution. Whereas the people who are really good at this work actually enjoy the execution and they're excited about building the system. And they're excited about, hey, I set up this new feedback loop such that every single week our product team gets to interview five of our users, five of whom are canceling and five of whom just started using the product. That's a fantastic win. You have to find someone who's excited about that versus sitting there saying, man, it'd be really nice if I could get more into the vision setting and the strategy. And those are, they're just different people with different strengths.
So do you see this product ops person as being more of a project manager?
Yeah, absolutely. Their job is to make sure that when the team decides that we are going to build X, that X actually gets shipped. They're not responsible for the taste, the craftsmanship, the value, the viability, like all of those other strategic things that impact whether it's going to be successful. You're just saying, and think of it in its simplest version. If you say that the product is going to have login with Google and login with Apple, this is the person making sure that when the devs surface that there is no Apple developer account, that someone goes and creates the Apple developer account, right? Like it's that level of tactics. It's not, you know, should we think about it this way? Should you have Apple and Google and something else? How do you make that decision? That's a product decision. That impacts who's going to adopt the product. That impacts what their likely privacy posture is. It impacts a whole bunch of other decisions. That's a different call.
Yeah. So about a year ago, I posted on LinkedIn and I had a post that went super, super viral and got over 1 million views on LinkedIn. And I will probably never do that again. But it was about how companies needed rock star requirements, not rock star developers. And I feel like in so many companies, the developers just don't know what to do, or the requirements are don't make a lot of sense, or the requirements are always changing. I'm curious what your take is on that problem when it comes to working with engineering.
Yeah, that's a really interesting take. So I think I can see where that would work on products that are breaking less emerging tech ground. So if you're building the next B2B vertical SaaS company that does something pretty narrow and the features that you need are not breaking new technical ground, right? For example, you're making a CRM for a new market, or you're making a tool to book tee times at golf courses or something like that, where you don't need a new technology stack, then I do think that you can work with a lot of engineers who are earning a little less, maybe a little bit less motivated by the mission. And if you very clearly articulate what it is that you want built, you can be successful. In the side of the market where I spend the majority of my time, deep emerging tech, solving problems that haven't been solved before, I think it's a recipe for everything to just fracture. Because what will happen is, and I've seen this happen, I've seen like very well-meaning, ambitious founders with a really bold vision hire even like B plus A minus engineers. So like pretty solid people, not like, you know, not duds by any stretch. And what happens is you can never write a perfect specification for what the feature should do. So if you don't have someone on the other end of that discussion that deeply cares about what we're trying to achieve and then applies their unique knowledge to the problem, you'll never get the absolute best solution. So I think basically it depends on what kind of product you're building. I think if the requirements are really straightforward for what you need, yeah, I don't think you have to overspend on engineers. I don't think your engineers have to be, you know, savants who are super creative and breaking ground on the tech and making their own GitHub repos for their unique opinionated way to solve the problem. But if you're on the emerging tech side, I think it is the way, not only that the other way doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're innovating super complex things, that it makes absolutely total sense. I get that for sure.
Yeah. Think about ChatGPT, for example. You know, that's not a product where I actually like to joke, and I know some of the people at OpenAI, so this is not meant personally, but I like to playfully joke with them that the first version of the product was super lazy product management, because they didn't help users figure out what to query or how to query. Like, it's just this blank box that you have to figure out. But because it's a pure emerging tech challenge, and because the challenge was, can we solve any open-ended question? That actually worked perfectly.
Right.
But you know what? But I guarantee you, like now that I see how the product has evolved over the past year and a half, I guarantee you they hired a bunch of product people over the last year and a half. Because all of a sudden, you're seeing things like custom GPTs, you're seeing better login experience, you're seeing people caring about like, what is it that people are trying to achieve with this? The API is better supported. The pricing model makes more sense. Like all of these things are happening. But for that initial innovative stage, where it was all about, you know, reading the latest paper that was published on AI and then testing something out. That was an almost pure engineering challenge for that phase. And it had to be at the top of the top.
So I've worked around software development engineering for almost 25 years. And from my perspective, I feel like the vast majority of developers struggle at product. They understand how to write code. They understand how to architect things and engineer things. But they struggle a little bit with the why are we doing this? And I feel like the difference between kind of your average developer and the absolute best developers is the product thinking, the understanding like, why are we doing this? Who is the customer? And understanding the big picture. And I'm kind of curious on your take on that and what you've seen from the best developers versus maybe your average developer.
Yeah, absolutely. So my most viral post coming back at you is about forward deployed product engineering, which was something that we developed at Palantir as a mantra of basically taking engineers and putting them into the field where the problems actually are, and then allowing them through that proximity to the problem to ultimately come up with better solutions. And at the end of the day, my feeling is that it's a certain type of personality, and it's not every engineer. But what I like to say to aspiring teams, especially building new things, is that some percentage of your engineering team needs to be willing to do that. They need to be excited by the idea of getting on a plane with product and design, flying out to wherever the customer happens to be, even if it's, you know, on the North Sea or somewhere undesirable or in the middle of nowhere and the best hotel has roaches, right? You have to, and these are real stories, I'm not making this up. You have to be willing to go do that. And the best engineers are actually the most pain in the ass for product people. Yeah. Right. And I say this like in a self-hating way almost, right? Because like the best engineers I've ever worked with are by far the hardest ones to work with. But, you know, through that pressure, carbon becomes diamonds, right?
Because they ask all the right questions, right? They ask all the questions that people that are just order takers are not going to ask those questions.
Yeah. I wrote a post a long time ago called something like, if you're not an engineer, how you can tell if you're working with a 10X engineer. And one of the things that I put in that post is you'll notice that you ask for X and you don't actually get X back. You get like 2X or 3X or sometimes 10X. You get something back where they say, you know, I thought about what you asked for and it occurred to me that it actually has these 4 shortcomings. So I just went ahead and built this wrapper around it and it takes care of those 5 cases that you weren't even thinking about. And then they ship that and you sit there and you're like, you're amazing. I love you. I can't wait for us to collaborate on the next problem. And it is a virtuous cycle because in a model like that, where it's really the tippy top engineering cohort and the tippy top product cohort, the product folks are spotting the best problems and bringing engineers to be near those problems. And then they're helping to work on the craftsmanship of the totality of what you're building, but they're not so much getting in the way of like the day-to-day, how exactly do we solve this exact little piece of the problem, right? They're giving, the engineering team has a lot more autonomy in that, and product, and you know, you hear a lot, the product trio, product, design, and engineering, but the reason it's so important and valuable is because each of those individuals is looking at the problem with a different lens. Product is looking at it to figure out, is this going to scale? Is it valuable? Is it going to work for our business? Is it something that people want? Is it going to wow them? Engineers look at it and they say, what's the most scalable and interesting way to do this? What new technologies are available that are really cool that could maybe speed this up by 100x? Design is thinking about it and they're saying, you know, I basically have a degree in psychology. They're saying to themselves, I know what the user is going to be thinking here. They're going to be confused by this part, but not that part. Maybe we can change the flow so that they can actually get to the value faster. And each of those unique viewpoints, each of which everyone in the trio should have tacit understanding of, but not be expert in, come together to make this massively valuable thing, especially when you forward deploy and get in your customer's environment. Not just to observe the work, but to do some of the real work, to really experience how the product is used.
Well, I think you highlight a good point that it takes all personalities, right? You need people that are experts at all these things. And I'd be the first one to tell you, I am probably not the best engineer or architect, but I am probably the best person in the world to write the first 80% of the code. The last 20%, somebody else is better at. But I can figure out the first 80% faster than anybody else just because my mind works differently. But I will not engineer it the most perfect way. Somebody else is probably better at that, right? There are just different people are so much better at different pieces of this. And ultimately, we need everybody working together to create the best solution.
Hey, man. I mean, it's I always like to describe teams as being the shape of an amoeba, right? It's like this very awkward shape. And then each teammate has their own shape, and you're trying to like fill out the surface area of the amoeba, and it never works perfectly, right? So you're always trying to pull these different personality traits in. And that's why I say, like, you know, take the opposite example. Let's say every single engineer on the team believes that they know what the right thing is to build, like every single one of them. Then what you get is like very little productization and very little follow through. So that's also a fail mode. Right. And so you actually have to find some amount of balance in these things in order to create world-changing products.
I think that's going to be my next blog post. I'm an 80% engineer.
The vanguard is extremely important. Like, I like to call it the vanguard, right? It's like you're the guy who's really good at getting the MVP in front of the first people. And that's a super valuable skill. But guess what? I bet I could make you cringe right now. All I have to say is, how do you feel about taking the design that design came up with and making sure that it's pixel perfect? Probably not exciting to you, right?
No.
But there's engineers who are like, hey, I want this to fully live up.
I'm gonna poke my eyes out.
Exactly, right? And that's just different personalities.
The hardest part of engineering, and I think all things in life, is when you're staring at the whiteboard or the blank piece of paper, right? And you're like, I don't know where to start. And there are some of us that are good at that, or like, I know exactly. Let's try this. Go, go, go. Right. And there's a lot of people that are like, I don't know where to start. Just tell me where to start. So it takes all of this, man. But that's the fun of like building software. Like, I enjoy that scenario of like, okay, let's start from scratch. How would we do this thing? But hey, I've really enjoyed having you on the show today. This has been fantastic. Why don't you tell us a little more about your product agency before we wrap up the show here? Love to have people understand more about what you do. And I don't know if you want to share pricing or any of that kind of stuff, but love to hear more about that.
Sure. Yeah. So at the end of the day, we provide two main things. We provide product coaches who are experts at the specific challenges that you're experiencing at the moment in time that you're experiencing them, not trying to shoehorn one product person who you already hired or one founder into magically knowing everything, because it could range from paid marketing to user interviews to scaling a completely difficult tech product to working with customer success, right? It could be very different things. And then we also do fractional engagements where we actually provide people inside your company to go do that work for you. So it's either helping you do it or doing it for you. Those are the two main things. And then of course we run workshops around these different technologies and procedures and ways to think about these problems. But those are the two main things we do. Your audience can find me and our coaches on www.firstprinciples.la. You can check me out on LinkedIn, or you can also follow my free Substack newsletter, which is Judelson, judelson.substack.com. The newsletter is called Emergent because I like to write about emerging technology challenges. And awesome. I'd love to talk to anyone.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. Again, this was Adam Judelson. Thank you so much. I think this was a great episode about product and overview of product especially for those who aren't sure what the heck product is. So thank you so much for doing this today.
My pleasure.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.